We all have fear that if I tell you what I've really done, you're going to think less of me. Then you're not going to love me. You're not going to accept me. You're not going to want me to be in your circle, and I'm going to be abandoned again. It all comes back to that orphan spirit that I had, and many of us have it, and it led to these improper actions of behaviors that I call in my book, soothing salves of addiction. Maybe your credit cards because you go do retail therapy. Maybe you were a sex addict. Maybe you're a drug addict. Maybe you're an alcoholic. I don't know. But we all have something that we go to try to reduce the pain and the suffering in a way that makes us feel like we are loved.
This is A Joyful Rebellion, the podcast that explores that moment you realize the life and success you worked so hard to create didn't come with all the fulfillment you thought it would. I'm your host, James Walters, and I want you to be the author of your own story. Each week, I connect with people who inspire bold answers to the question, what do I do now to create a life I love? If you are ready to start answering that question for yourself, you're in the right place. So let's start A Joyful Rebellion. Everyone you know is going through or has gone through a period of their life so challenging or negative that it makes them question their faith or their purpose in this world. My guest today knows that feeling all too well and has earned what I think of as multiple PhDs from the School of Hard Knocks. And he's come through those experiences with a stronger understanding of his faith and a commitment to use his familiarity with trauma to help others find hope for themselves. Ricky Sluder is a survivor of childhood trauma and has battled complex PTSD himself, which helped him develop a faith-based alternative to the traditional mental health counseling model. His approach is to coach people who feel sidelined by life in a way that uses their past difficulties as fuel to get them back into the game. In 2022, Ricky published his book, Accepting Truth, Finding Hope. And we're going to dive super deep into his story, so buckle up extra secure for this one. It might just be the most real interview I've done so far. Ricky Sluder, welcome to A Joyful Rebellion. I've been excited to have this conversation because I learned about you, I read your bio, learned about your book several weeks ago when we scheduled this. And I gotta say, when I read through your bio, I thought to myself, everyone around us is going through their own stuff. And in reading what you've been through in your life, it reads like a mashup between an episode of Law and Order and a Stephen King novel.
I like it.
I don't say that to make light of it at all, but I do want to prepare anyone listening that we're going to go kind of deep and things might get heavy for a minute, but our collective purpose here is there is hope and there's healing and just know that things are going to end well. And that's what I really want to talk to you about today, because you went through a lot of dark stuff after that, trying to deal with the aftermath. It sounded like you went through a lot of just not understanding why you were here, why you're on earth, what your purpose was. And then you found your way through that. And that's what this podcast is all about. It's about people who maybe they are successful in a lot of ways in their life, but they'd come to a point in their life where they realize it's not them and they need to figure out, okay, what do I do now? You talk a lot about acceptance, and I want to get into that. Sometimes it's about accepting themselves, and they have been looking outside of themselves for that acceptance. So tell us a little bit about where things started for you, because you're a great example of someone who has led their own joyful rebellion. They kind of came out of the other side of that identity crisis, and now you help other people do it. So kick us off with the quick bio of what got you here.
Yeah, childhood. I think we all could probably look back at childhood and say, man, if that had been different or this had been different. For me, it was my dad and my mom had this outward idyllic marriage, but they really didn't. And my dad had come from nothing. And he had started this business. He was doing well. It was about 1979. And the man defrauded him for about $90,000. I mean, that was a lot of money back then. Yeah. And my dad made the conscious decision that the IRS, they'll be okay if they don't get my $30,000 in taxes. But these men who rely on a paycheck every week, they won't be okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pay my men. I'll worry about the taxes later. The IRS thought, you thought wrong, pal. And they seized everything we owned. Oh. And yeah, they were not the kind of gentle IRS back then. They were ruthless. And I even had a savings account. I'm like, or they seized my money.
Good grief.
In the interest of the Republic, okay? I say in my book, that's where the hurricane off the storm of my father's life began. He became so angry, James. He wanted to murder this man because he felt ruined. And there was no joyful rebellion in his future, the way he could see it. So he did what we all do. He took it out on the people that are closest to you. And that was me, my mom, and my sister. He became very violent. When I say violent, I watched him tear a recliner in half with his bare hands. I still don't know how he did it. That much rage. And he had purpose in his heart to kill all of us and kill himself. And I still don't know what made him not do it that night. I found him under his truck. I'm about 7 years old. He had a loaded 44 to his head. And of course, went and told my mom. And I really thought we were all going to go meet Jesus. That's where it began. And the fear from him, and then my mom just got lost in her own way as a result of him. And they ended up divorcing. And we went from living on a farm and having livestock and fruit trees and gardens to living in a small two-bedroom apartment where I slept on a couch. And I didn't understand why I didn't get to bring any of my toys. I'm a little boy. I'm 8 years old. My sister got to keep all her stuff, but I got to keep nothing. It was just it was a very odd thing. But I didn't know what I didn't know. So I wasn't focusing on that. I was focusing more on, hey, I want these people to love me.
Yeah.
And I got to figure out how to get them to love me, because I obviously I'm not doing it right. Otherwise, my dad wouldn't have left, or my mom would want to spend time with me, and he doesn't come around and she doesn't want to spend time with me. Something I'm doing wrong. And that's when I began running on that rat wheel of insanity, striving for acceptance, man. I'll pause there and let you guide me from there. But that's where it all began. It was a huge storm, and I thought it was my storm, James. Turns out I was just getting rained on.
Oh, that's a good way to put it. I really like that, because you don't have that perspective when you're that age. You think there's something going on. I didn't have that
perspective until I was 45.
Oh, wow. It
took a long time to figure that out. I know it now, and I guess that's what's important.
Yeah. So is this part of, or does it tie into what you say in your book? You say that we all fall victim to what's called the anatomy of a stronghold.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. We buy into the lies, the improper belief systems, that kind of thing. Is that part of what carried into a lot of the other parts of your life when you adopted that belief that you needed to do or be something else to find acceptance from people?
100%. While my dad is going mental, literally, he ended up checking himself into an institution, got himself help. Good for him, right? Never became a dad, but at least he arrived course on wanting to kill people.
Mm.
And with that in the background, at the same time, I developed a condition that wasn't diagnosed until I literally was 45, called eosinophilic esophagitis. Short version, I'm allergic to damn near every single thing I eat every day. So I was miserably sick all the time. 100 to 106 temperature every day for 8 years straight. I was eating everything I was allergic to. So my body was just revolting. And then all the stress that was going on with that divorce and the violence. And at the same time, if that wasn't bad enough, I was molested. And the day that I was molested, I also discovered pornography. If the wheels couldn't have fell off my wagon any worse in that 1 year of my life, I don't know how else they could have. And that was the beginning of that stronghold, okay? That stronghold, as you just mentioned, I did. I bought the lies. People told me that I was worthless, that I sucked, that I was this or that. Or my dad would call me the P word. Not something you'd call a little boy. Mm. I didn't want to be that, but I bought the lie. And that informed my identity in a very bad way. And then, my security became insecurity. And then, I wondered, why, God, would you even create somebody like me? You clearly don't like me. You wouldn't have given me these circumstances if you did.
Yeah.
And so I challenged constantly, what is my purpose? Why in the hell am I even alive? Other than to struggle all the time. I'm a whipping boy. That's what I told myself constantly.
Wow. That's never a good feeling to have or thought. And then having that at 6 and 7 years, or 7 and 8 years old, and repeating that over, and then fast forward into your teenage years, it sounds like it didn't drastically improve.
I got worse far before it ever got better. I was running the wrong crowd, being a child who didn't have my dad around, and my mom worked 2 jobs. She was never around, didn't spend time with me. So what is a boy left to do? I went from living on a farm to living in an apartment complex on the wrong side of the tracks. I had to create situated identity. I had to become something that I really wasn't. And the crowd that I was hanging around was rough, to say the least. And the friends that I was with one night near Christmas time, I was 14. We went to a pawn shop. We'd been drinking. I drank a lot back then. And I started about 13 years of age, smoked a pack a day. And that's what you did when you're poor white trash. So we're at this pawn shop about 1 a.m. We're going to pawn a ring so we can get more beer money. And as two of the folks that I was with went inside, car pulls up. These guys have, it's a Mexican gang. I don't know how else to say it. They had trench coats on. I recognized exactly who they were and thought, oh shit, sue me bad. And sure enough, when my crew come out of the pawn shop, they jump them, knife fight ensues, and I'm in the car, and the fight spills to the car, and a guy is trying to get in the car. He gets in. Since then, James, I've looked into the eyes of evil, played police officer for 10 years and dealt with some really hardcore folks. But this guy, the look in his eyes, I've never seen replicated. It was the most evil I've ever seen. And he came into the car as I was trying to come out of the car, and he put a knife between my eyes and backed me against the driver window. And he told me he was going to kill me. There was no question in my mind that he was going to. But something in me, I know now, I'd say the Holy Spirit, I was given a gift in that moment. I talked him out of killing me, 14. And I remember the look on his face. He was so befuddled. Like, why am I going to do what this kid's telling me to do? Oh. And he couldn't reconcile. I could tell. But he slowly backed the knife away. I hit it. It stuck literally into my bridge of my nose. And he backed it away. And he finally exited out of the car. And as he did, within 30 seconds, I watched a friend of mine kill him with a machete. Threw his back out his chest, dead on the ground. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, I may have been born into this, but I'll be damned if I die this way. Something's got to change. Something's got to change. And for me, that was a bit of a tipping point. In every movie we watch, there's always an inciting event. Okay, that was one of the many inciting events in my life that made me realize I want more than this. And I don't know how I'm going to get it, but I'm going to figure it out. I've got to.
Yeah. And at age 14, you saw someone die right in front of you. So obviously, that's a lot of people's worst fear is death. And you knew, hey, I don't want that. Things might be bad, but that's really bad and I want to avoid it. And so I'm curious, was that kind of the beginning of what got you asking questions about yourself? What could life be like?
In a roundabout way, yes. I have to back up a little bit. I always knew there was a God. I didn't grow up in church. I didn't have theology of any sort. I just believed there was something greater than me. But he must be mad at me. That was the way I saw it. Mm-hmm. And I really started as a result of that thinking, how can I please that God so this won't keep happening to me? That was really my mindset. So I started trying to read the Bible. Good Lord, King James Version. There wasn't online resources back then. I predate the internet, right? So it was, how do you make sense of this stuff? And yeah. If I read the Old Testament, it was usually the hellfire and brimstone. And I didn't know what those stories and that. I just thought, confirmed, he hates me. And he's just waiting to fuck me off this planet. So I better watch my P's and Q's. Now, did I? No. I kept doing the same thing, expecting a different result. That's what most of us do. But I did go to my high school counselor. I did say to him, sir, I'll be the second person in my entire family to ever graduate high school. Second. I need help. I can't go to anybody and ask them for help. I want to go to college. I want to make something out of my life. Now, mind you, my hair's past my shoulders. I reek of cigarettes, got the porn stash going. You would have changed the sidewalk if you saw me coming. Ripped jeans. I was rough. Okay. And he looks at me and he says, Ricky, you're just really not college material. And I said, damn, why? Why am I not college material? I've got straight A's. Help me with, why can't I go to college? He said, you really should consider automotive technician school. And it pissed me off, James, because not that there's anything wrong with that, but I knew that wasn't my aptitude. And I knew what he was doing. He was looking at me, he was judging me to be poor white trash and telling me, don't even think about crossing those tracks. You stay on your side. Mm-hmm. I left that office and I said to myself, F you, I will go to college and I'll prove you wrong. That was that inciting event that just lit a fire under my ass in a way that I said, you know what? Nobody's going to tell me I can't. I will prove them wrong. I was working from spite. It's a horrible place to work from.
It's pretty motivating, though, sometimes at that age, especially.
Yeah. But it at least propelled me, I guess you could say, in a new direction that was positive overall, regardless of what I was using as fuel to get me there.
When did your relationship with understanding and coming to a sense of peace with the fact that there was a God, that you understood, you felt that there is a God, but he's now not trying to punish you for anything? Yeah. What was that transformation like?
It took a long time. So after I went to college, became a police officer, made detective in my first year, and I thought, okay, a little bit of sunshine, smiling on me, right? But I know he's still mad at me back here in the background. Mm. My best friend was killed in the line of duty, Trooper Kurt David Knapp, on May 8th, 2004. And that's the first time I ever challenged the living God. And I went to him and I said, you screwed this up. You got the wrong guy. Everybody loved Kurt. He had two young kids. His wife and he had been together since they were in sixth grade. Mm. His parents loved them. I don't have anybody. Nobody loves me. You effed this up. You should have taken me. I've been begging you to get me off this damn marble, and you took the guy who wanted to be here. What are you doing? And it was that moment that then opened me up to realize I can go into the throne room. I can throw that hissy fit if I want to. God's big enough. He can handle it. But I didn't have any theology really still. I was trying to understand. I kept going to the Word and trying to understand it, listening to preachers. But the thing that really kicked it off was when I was 32 years old and my wife and I were at a point where we said, you know what? We're done. We've been living a lie. I've been in multiple affairs. I was living a complete shit show of a life. Okay, James. And we agreed to divorce. And then the next minute she tells me I'm pregnant. And I went, you've got to be kidding me. We're not even sleeping together. So I'd love to know how that happened. But that aside, I just went right to the railing on God again and was like, what are you doing? Don't make this kid relive my life. Please, I'm begging you. I'll do anything to prevent that. And I finally realized in that moment of just railing at God again that, wait a second, I don't create life. You do. I don't know what else to do right now other than just, you gave me this kid. I dedicate this kid back to you. You do what you want. And I'll just suck it up because I don't know what else to do. And my daughter, I ended up having heart defects. They told us that she would not be viable. They told us that her head, arms, and legs weren't growing properly and that we should abort her. And I thought, what is my life? Seriously. But God had downloaded poetry into me 10 years earlier. And he had given me a poem called Dear Mom, which was about abortion. And that very day, I found it on my computer, as Providence would have it. And I read it and I realized, I can't terminate this life. I cannot do it. And I went to my wife and I told her, I said, I don't know where you stand on this, but I can't do that. And she said, good, because I can't either. Mm-hmm. So we watched as blood flew through these. She basically had a two-chamber heart. Okay, she had no heart wall separating her atria. We didn't know it until birth, but she also didn't have one separating her ventricles. At birth, they tell us that not two heart defects, but four, no heart walls. Mitral valve is leaking profusely. There's a membrane occluding her pulmonary vein, and that she will die at 3 weeks old due to congestive heart failure, and there's nothing we can do to save her. And James, I just, being the type A control freak that I had been all my life, trying to figure out how I was going to get a leg up, I went home at 1 a.m. that night when my daughter was born, after that terrific news. And I sat on my back porch, a lit cigarette, my dogs ran around, and I'm going to the bathroom, and I just said, I lifted my arms up to heaven, and I said, you got me. I've been trying to figure out all day how I'm going to control my way out of this one, and I can't. All I know to do is to tell you that you give me this kid a day, a week, or a year, and I will praise you still, because I don't know what else to do. And I literally, from the first time in my heart, I surrendered, and I said, you know what? Your will be done. I don't even know what that really means, but I'm here, and I'm just surrendering. And nothing crazy happened, per se, except on the third day, the doctor reapproached me and told me that, hey, I re-ran tests, you watched it with me. She now has a perfect septum between her ventricles and the membrane blocking her pulmonary vein. There's no evidence it was ever there. She was miraculously healed. And he told me, he said, this is physiologically impossible. And I went, it's a miracle. He goes, I don't believe in those. I said, you believe in what you want, man. I'm taking it for what I think it is. And I said, what does this mean? He said, you'll take her home on Friday. You want to guess what Friday was? Good Friday. He got my attention with that moment. I had to take a step back and say, I've had all this wrong about you. I still don't understand why you let me go through so much stuff. I still don't understand all of the heartache and the adversity and all that crap. But you just did something that disproved my theory about you. You saved my child when I really expected you to take her away from me because I didn't deserve her to begin with. But now I see that you think that I maybe am worthy of that love. And you gave her to me. When she was four, she had open heart surgery. She had five strokes. I was right back where I started. But I had been studying. I had been sitting at the feet of gifted teachers like Chuck Swindoll and David Jeremiah via the radio, and was really trying to understand this God in a new way. And I had really learned a lot. And when they told me that she'd never talk again, she'd never walk again, what you see is what you get from these five strokes at four, I just went to the Lord and I said, you know what? I'm an idiot, Lord, because I told you a day, a week, or a year, and you gave me 4X on what I asked for. So I can't bitch a lick. But here's where I'm at. I've learned some things since then. You tell us to tell you the desires of our heart, desire of my heart. I want my daughter back, and I want her better than she was before. And crazily enough, man, I also surrendered and said, you know what? You don't want that. I'll accept this. Third day again in that ICU, all fine and gross motor skills came back in a blink. 3 months later, she had the expressive language ability of a seven-year-old. Total brain damage. No way the neural pathways could ever form again, neurologist said. Today, she's an honor student. She wants to be a nurse, wants to be in medicine, help others. She's a dwarf, clinically, little person, 4'4". I'm 6', almost four. So we're Mutt and Jeff when we walk together. But she's doing great. And I thought to myself then, why do you keep doing this? And the evolution of me as a man, the path, if you will, that took me from valley of hopelessness to a path of purpose was God showing me through extreme adversity, these bad things aren't what you think they are. These storms of life aren't always your storm. Yeah, sometimes you're getting rained on and sometimes it sucks, but there's a purpose for it. There's a reason behind it. And I finally discovered what that was, but I was about 38, 39 years old before it ever really dawned on me.
It's interesting, isn't it, that in the conversations I have with a lot of people, that tends to be the range. You mentioned 45 a good bit too. So like anywhere between 38, 45, I don't know where the wisdom starts to come from, but it starts to flood in and you're like, oh man, I wish I'd known that 10 years ago and things would be different. But how could they be? Because you had to go through those things to get that wisdom. It's like people say, you gain wisdom by making mistakes. You make mistakes because you do stupid things, and then you gain wisdom because you did stupid. I forget the exact wording of it, but it's like you can't get that wisdom unless you've done that other stuff. And all the things that you've gone through, when was it through that journey from we've gone from when you were seven all the way up now to where you've had a daughter of your own, and how you know how your childhood was, you don't want that repeated in her. At what point, because I know you talk a lot about myth busting, I guess you'd call it the traditional mental health industrial complex, if you want to call it that. And at what point did you start seeking that out and realizing it wasn't working for you and you needed to lean on your faith more than lean on that traditional method of therapy?
Yeah, I was in my second marriage. I'm 3 times divorced. I got some stripes. And during my second marriage, that marriage was just a marriage of passion. I was a full-blown sex addict and had been for a long time and didn't know it. But I knew that I had a lot of PTSD. You can't spend 10 years in law enforcement and not have PTSD. But when you couple it with my childhood, now it becomes complex PTSD. And I had no desire to talk to anybody. I wasn't about to go to somebody and say that I have a problem, because I was the kind of guy who thought I had to have it all figured out. And I needed to have that polished life. Why? Because I needed people to tell me I'm good, to tell me they love me.
Yeah.
And I started going to church to save my second marriage. She recommended that we do that. And so we did. And I found the men's group. And it changed my life. The men's pastor saw right through my BS. And he asked me to do a couple of things. I went on these, you can call them retreats. They weren't retreats. I met God in a tangible way, and it blew my brains out of my skull cap in a way that I went, one, I've had you completely wrong. I thought I did. I'm glad I did. Now I started working on a relationship. And I said, screw religion. It's not about the rules. This is about relationship. And I really started fostering a relationship with God. But meanwhile, I'm still a train wreck. I'm still doing all the crap I'd always done. It hadn't set into me for me to really start changing my ways. And I decided to go to my men's pastor, Scott. And I went to him one day and I said, look, I need help. Okay. I've never told anybody the things I'm struggling with, but here's what I'm struggling with. And he said, Ricky, I can't help you. You need professional help. And man, James, it pissed me off. And I thought, F you, buddy. Supposed to be my friend. Some friend you are, right? No, he was right. And he recommended me to the guy who ended up being one of the same called Quest. He was a Quest brother. And so I thought, okay, I can trust him. because he'll understand what I experienced at Quest. So I went to him, and he's a counselor. He's a good counselor. He couldn't bring faith into it. He couldn't bring a lot of the stuff in because of the way the system is set up. And he would sidebar some things with me. But on the record, it was always, how does it make you feel? Damn it, I'm tired of you asking me how it makes me feel. I want solutions to these problems. Right. I don't want to keep just talking about the problem, right? But the model is set up to talk about the problem. And the model is set up to then, well, take medication. If you can't handle what you're dealing with, let's throw some pills down your throat, right?
And you're thinking, man, I've been taking medication for the last however long. It's just been either the sex or the booze or the whatever it was, right?
I mean, yeah. And all that stuff, all the medication did was just make me numb, maybe not care or reduce my sexual urges, which probably was a good thing. But at the same time, that's a side effect, right? It's not the intended effect of the medication. And so I just thought, I did the individual counseling. I also went and did an intensive outpatient group therapy session, thinking there's got to be something that I'm missing, right? And I did learn some things, don't get me wrong. But again, the dinner goal was Michelle medication, and everybody in this room with me had been doing this for 20 years.
Oh.
I sat back in my chair, and these people were younger than me. And I sat back in my chair, and I went, if you think I'm coming to this thing 3 days a week, 3 hours each session, and I'm going to do this for the next 20 years, you people are nuts. It ain't going to happen. There's got to be a better way. That's when God really put me in this wilderness, I call it, where I spent the next 7 years where I just intently spent time with him. I woke up at 5 a.m. I started my day reading the word. I started my day journaling. And I really just started pouring everything into my relationship with God. And he began communicating with me in ways that most people would say, you probably needed to be in those therapy programs because you're crazy. I'm not. And he began showing me things. And part of that was he gave me those four words, acceptance, identity, security, and purpose. And when he unpacked them for me, he led me to Revelation 3:20. And Revelation 3:20 says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. Anyone who hears my voice and opens the door and lets me in, I will come into him and eat with him and he with me. And I remember when I read it, I thought, okay, that makes sense. I've seen that painting with Jesus knocking on the door. There's no doorknob. He can't let himself in, right? We got to accept him in. But he said to me, yeah, but what have you done? And I went, a lot of bad stuff. What are you asking me? And he said, you've gone around knocking on heart's doors, Ricky, seeking who would let you in. And the moment they let you in, they let you down, didn't they? And I went, yeah, they did. And he said, and you kept doing it. You've done that rat wheel of insanity. And he said, and you thought your identity, you thought your first name was detective for 10 years until I took it away from you. And then he didn't know who you were, did you? And I went, still don't. And he said, and then your security was in all the temporal things, and you thought your purpose was to be an investigator and to die in the line of duty. He said, as if I'm that shallow of a God. He said, but when you get it right, son, you'll realize acceptance isn't for you. Acceptance is for me. You got to offer me your acceptance. And when you do, I'll show you who you are. I'll lead you to your identity. And at that point, he had. And I said, you're right. You did. I know exactly who I am today. Then he said, you'll find your security in me and in my word. You won't worry when bad things happen in this life. You'll find peace in the middle of that storm, just like my little boat on my book cover shows. Mm. Because you'll know that you don't have to worry about the wind and the waves. Because you'll realize that I created you on purpose for a purpose. He said, that's what I want you to go teach. That's why I let so many hellacious things happen in your life. I needed you to be relatable. Oh, wow. I wanted you to be able to sit down with anybody and say, I understand where you've been. And let me tell you about a God who loves me. And if he can love me, he can love you.
Those four words that you mentioned, those are a big part of your book, which is called Accepting Truth, Finding Hope.
Yes, sir.
When it comes to those four words, acceptance, identity, security, and purpose, you've come a long way. We've gone through the transition of you being a kid, being abandoned by people who were supposed to provide you that security. And then you had that struggle with identity. Then you had to figure out, okay, what is the purpose of all of this? You thought at one point your purpose was to just be the whipping boy for the world. When you sit down and you talk to someone who is where you were, let's say 15 years ago, how do you start to have that conversation with them in a way that doesn't push them off? Or maybe you got pissed off by the men's pastor, but it sounded like you needed to be just a little bit. And then you learned something from that as well. But how do you start to talk to someone who's seen a tenth maybe of what you have but is still having the same anguish over finding their identity, finding security and their purpose. What's that conversation like with you?
I always want to hear their story, and I always encourage them, start from the beginning. Okay, the beginning is important. Tell me about your childhood. Tell me about the relationship you had with your mom and your dad. Open that closet door and let me see the skeletons. And many times they don't want to. So I always say, let me start off. Okay, why do I do that?
Hold my beer in a way.
Yes, but no. Okay, yeah. Because what I learned, the first event that I ever went to was called Encounter Weekend that Scott encouraged me to go to. I had so much on my chest, I couldn't hold it in anymore. And I volunteered to be the first guy. And I thought, I don't know any of you guys. I don't care what you think about me. I got to get this out of me. It's venom and it's got to come out. I confessed everything. And when I mean everything, I told some stuff that I thought was going to my grave with me. Mm. I told it all. Every man who came behind me, it's like they repeated everything I said. And I marveled. And this was not just one guy. This was like 10 guys. They all came up to me and said, thank you for going first and saying what you did. I never would have had the courage to confess those things had you not done it. So what I learned in that is we all have fear, James. We all have fear that if I tell you what I've really done, you're going to think less of me. And then you're not going to love me. You're not going to accept me. You're not going to want me to be in your circle. And I'm going to be abandoned again. Okay. It all comes back to that orphan spirit that I had. And many of us have it, regardless of whether you've gone through the things that I've gone through or not. You've gone through your own journey. You're on your own walk. And it's important to know, where did the stronghold grab hold of you? Who lied to you? Who told you that you're not worthy? Every single person you talk to will tell you they've had someone who has lied to them, and they bought it wholesale, formed an improper belief, and it led to these improper actions of behaviors that I call in my book, soothing salves of addiction. Maybe credit cards because you go do retail therapy. Maybe you were a sex addict like I was, or you're addicted to pornography. Maybe you're a drug addict. Maybe you're an alcoholic. I don't know, right? But we all have something that we go to try to reduce the pain and the suffering in a way that makes us feel like we are loved, because that's what we want. We all want hope. We say we want happiness, but really we want hope. Yeah. And we look for it in other people, and we look for it in other things, and we'll never find it there. We just feel more empty than we started. Where did you buy the lie? Now let's start pulling the roots of this stuff out of the garden of your mind. Let's get rid of all those negative weeds that are in there. We can clean that up. That can get you to start seeing things in a better frame of light. And many people will say, I don't believe the way you believe. And I'll say, neither did I. How's that working for you, by the way? Right? You can keep doing it your own way if you want to. I'll be unapologetic about my faith because I've seen things that I can't make sense of. Maybe you haven't. That's okay. If instead of saying you're one of those crazy Christian guys, yeah, I didn't start out that way. So maybe there's something to this. Maybe there is a God. And maybe I don't have it all right with my theology. I don't really give a damn. It's not about the rules, right? So how about you at least just borrow something from my journey and apply it into your own life and see if it doesn't bring change. If it does, maybe then you have to start asking some tough questions about what you believe.
The results, what we look for, right? And a lot of times, so many people say, oh, it's the journey, it's the process. But a lot of times we're looking for the results, and that's what gets us in trouble in the first place. But then when we do start applying and we do the work, because the work sucks sometimes. Yeah,
it's the worst.
The work really sucks. But when we start seeing results, whether that's that couple pounds you want to get rid of, whether that's the relationship improving and whoever you're with is flirting with you a little more than usual, whatever that result is that you're wanting, you got to pay attention to that. And I'm curious, when it came to the point where you gained all of this perspective, all of this wisdom, was it someone who told you, hey, Ricky, you should really write a book about this? You could help a lot of people. Or is that something that came up organically as you were doing your work? How did that work from going from gaining all of this knowledge, perspective, having all of these experience, horrific experiences in life, then deciding, you know what, I should put that in print and let a lot of people read about it?
Yeah, there were a couple of things that happened, and I know we don't probably have a lot of time to delve into all of it. So at the risk of people thinking I'm really nuts, I had an angelic encounter when I was 22 years old in a bar. That story goes very simply. I was with a bunch of buddies. I knew everybody in this bar. I had shut it down many a night. And out of the corner of my eye, I see a waitress I had never seen before. And I mentioned to you that I'd been getting poetry downloads. Mm-hmm. I was 22 and I had just gotten a poetry given to me called Oh, What a Day That'll Be. And I didn't tell people I was writing these spiritual poems, right? I just kept it to myself. And I'm with my buddies. We're drinking. We're being guys trying to find who we're going to take home that night. And I see this beautiful creature walking toward me with a tray on her hand. And so I'm like, see you, homies, right? I'm check her out. So I turn around and she walks up to me, doesn't ask me what drink I want. On her tray, to this day, I can still vividly see it. It's just napkins and a pen. No water rings, no edifices that there was ever a drink on that tray. Okay. Mm-hmm. Doesn't ask me what drink I want. She starts the conversation. It's about God. And I took a napkin. I wrote on the napkin the poem that I have just been given. I spin it around that tray and I pass it toward her. She never looks at it, looks me dead in the eyes and said, I know you're going to be in ministry, but not until you're in your 40s. And I started laughing and I turned around. I grabbed my buddy Scott. I'm like, dude, you got to hear this shit. Turn around. She's gone.
Oh.
And I was like, this waitress just told me I'm going to be in ministry. And he's like, dude, you're drunk. And I went, no, I'm really not. I know how to drink and I ain't drunk yet. And I was just talking to her. This is what she looked like. And he said, Ricky, you were standing there talking to no one, staring at the bar.
Oh.
And I went, you're nuts. And I'm going to prove you're wrong. And I searched that bar high and low, James, and I couldn't find her.
Oh.
And that moment stuck with me. Okay. I couldn't let it go. And I just reconciled that she got off early. She left. That's why I couldn't find her. Never thought it was an angelic encounter to save my life. But I kept thinking, why would she tell me I'm going to be in ministry? I'm the last person who should be in ministry. I like my bourbon strong, I like my women hot, and I got a foul mouth. So nobody wants me to be a preacher. Move forward in time. After I left law enforcement, I'm on an airplane in my second marriage, 2013. And I've been first class. I was a concierge key holder. I'm traveling the world all the time, making great money, doing technology consulting. And I fell asleep. And I don't normally fall asleep on an airplane. And I hear, wake up. And I thought, oh my God, I was snoring. I'm looking around and everybody else is asleep too. And I'm like, I just looked at him and I went, did you tell me to wake up? Because nobody here told me to wake up. That's when I heard the second voice, as I call it, in my as thoughts I'm not thinking. And it was so loud that it was unmistakable. And he said, yes, wake up. Everything that was will have nothing to do with that which is to come. What? And he said, everything that was will have nothing to do with that which is to come. And I said, you could repeat yourself. It doesn't mean I understand it better.
Need your secret decoder ring for that.
I know. And he goes, think about it. He said, what I'm calling you to do, you're going to write books, you're going to write movies, you're going to teach, and you're going to preach. Actually, he said, you're going to act as well. And I went, I have lost my ever-loving mind. Why am I having these delusions of grandeur? Like, I'm crazy, effing crazy. What is in my scotch, right? Or in Jack Daniels that I have here. And I was like, okay, but I couldn't let that go either. Like that was stuck in my crawl, so to speak. And so when he gave me these words, those four words, that's when God said, that's your ministry. That's what I want you to write a book about. The book will precede everything else. And I set out to write the book. It took me 5 years. I had to live every single chapter. I've never wanted something to be over with.
Yeah.
So fast in my life. But it took a long time. And once I finished it, then I realized I can't be the same guy. I can't go backwards. I have to take what God's given me and I have to do something good with it. I've got to share this information with people. They need it just like I needed it. And I wish somebody had told me he was preparing me to be the person to go tell others who have camped out in the valley. We've all heard the scripture, walk through the valley of the shadow of death, right? The key word is you walk through it. You don't set up a tent. You don't camp out there and stay there thinking that that's where you belong, because it's not. So what he told me was, I'm sending you to the valley. You're no stranger. You know the valley well. Mm. Go there, tell them your story, and point back to me and say, go home to daddy. He's waiting for you. Just like the prodigal son story. Get out of your pig shit. Go home. And that was the calling he put in my life. And right now I'm writing my daughter's miracle story as a movie. It's been called A Heart for Kylie. And as a double entendre, I'll tell the miracle story, but I'm also sharing how he irrevocably changed an absolute lunatic of a human that I was at that time. When he healed her heart, he changed mine. And so sure enough, man, I'm doing all the things he told me that I was going to do on that airplane when I thought I was crazy 11 years ago. But it just took a lot of living to finally realize that, all right, I'm not crazy. This is a calling and I've got to do something with it. And when God tells you to act, you can't hesitate.
Wow. Now you've got the book and now you actually coach people who want a better sense of acceptance and identity and security and purpose. And maybe they don't know what their purpose is, but you have a way that they can reach out to you and get some coaching. What's it look like to do coaching with you and how's the best way for them to get in touch?
My book, Accepting Truth, Finding Hope, is also the brand that I have for my business. So it's all in one name. AcceptingTruthFindingHope.com is how you would find me. What does it look like? It looks like what most people would think if you go to see a counselor. Here's the difference, okay? The reason that I thought coaching, two reasons. One, to be at an LPC or to have all those credentials and take insurance and all that stuff, you got to do a lot of time in school. I'm 48. I don't have time to go back to school to do this stuff. And the more I thought about it, it dawned on me one day when a buddy of mine that I hadn't spoken to in a long time, he's an American Airlines pilot. He picked up the phone and called me and he said, Ricky, I bought your book. I've been reading it. He said, my God, man, this is incredible stuff. And I went, wow, thank you, Chad. I appreciate the compliment. He said, no, I don't think you realize what you have here. He said, if the Bible is the rule book, then your book is the playbook. And I went, playbook. I kind of like that. That's a hell of a compliment, first of all. And two, there's something to that. And so the more I thought about it, I realized you want to talk to a counselor, you'll talk about your problems. But if you're sidelined by life, that tagline, I couldn't get it out of my head. If you feel sidelined, if you feel like you've been on the bench and you don't know how to get off of it, you need a coach. That's what coaches do. I grew up in sports. They always have a playbook. They're usually tough on you, and sometimes it sucks, but they turn you into a better athlete if you're willing to do the hard work, just like you said. And so what does it look like with me? It's just like that. I don't care where you've come from. I don't care what your tell of woe is. We all have one. I do want to hear it. It matters. But let's start thinking about how we can take that problem and let's create a solution. Let's get you off that bench and let's get you back in the game. Let's point you to the path of purpose and let's get you on it. Okay. I don't want to spend weeks and years talking about the same stuff that you're struggling with. We need to figure out how to overcome it. So the whole point to what I put together in my coaching packages is that we're going to identify, we're going to overcome, and we're going to grow from those negative life circumstances. That's the goal. Now you just need somebody to help you get there, right? If we can do it alone, we'd all figure it out.
Yeah.
But we weren't intended to do it alone. That's why we all live on this great big marble, 8 billion of us together, right? With all these other things out there that God could have put us all on our own planet if he wanted us on one. No, he wanted us to be in a relationship with one another and with him. And I know my purpose is to help people find their way out of those dark valleys.
It's a great purpose and certainly hard earned over many years.
You know what, James, I find myself now waking up telling him, thank you. Thank you that my daughter had these problems. Thank you for the strokes. Thank you for the adversity. And I mean it. Thank you that you let me go through those things. I found my way to Thanksgiving in all of that hell. I'm not angry about it anymore. And it took a process and some time to figure that out. But in the book of Jonah, everybody knows at least the part about the great fish. Hey, Jonah spit him out on the shore of Nineveh. But what most people don't know is at the end of the book, Jonah was a hateful prophet. He wanted the Ninevites to burn because he didn't agree with them. We've all felt that way about somebody, right? And God asked him at the end of that book, he said, Jonah, does it do you well to be angry? And one of the things that I always ask, because most of the people have fear and they have anger when they're dealing with these life issues, and I'll tend to ask them, just like God asked Jonah, is it doing you well to be angry? At some point, you've got to put that emotion down, because that's all it is an emotion. And you have to find your way to other emotions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it, because that's something we overlook a lot.
It's easy to be angry. So easy to be angry.
I don't know if you agree on this, but I feel like as men, not to disclude the women, but I know a lot about men just from being one, I guess, but it feels like anger and humor are the only two emotions we're really allowed on a consistent basis, or we get a free pass. He's going to get angry or he's going to make a joke about it, whatever it is. But I'm interested in what maybe one of your first, let's say two or three coaching clients, like what did you help them through? What's the story behind that? And how did you feel? And I know we're talking about feelings, man, that's weird for me to do. But how did it feel when you helped someone else who was struggling with their identity or purpose or security and acceptance, when you led them to that aha moment and you saw it, you saw something switch in them, what was that like for you, and what led up to that?
The first thing that I realized I had to do was to not be in control of the situation. Okay, so if you and I are going to go hike in the mountains, chances are we're going to hire a Sherpa. Why? Because that guy or gal has already walked those paths. What I realized from just my own journey was that, when do I stop to just look around and go, oh, look, there is some beauty in the midst of all my torrential bad stuff, as I say. And I really try to help the person see, what percent is this issue in your life? And what percent of your focus have you placed on it? 82.3% of all statistics are made up on the spot. I just made it. So I would submit for consideration, though, that usually it's 1% or less of your life, but 99% of your focus. As you're chirping, okay, along this journey, the first thing that I want you to realize is you've got to stop staring at that one thing. If you and I are in an automobile, for example, and you're the driver, my hope is that you're not looking in the rearview mirror the entire time we're driving somewhere, because you're going to wreck. The windshield is the largest thing in front of you. The rearview mirror is just big enough for you to see where you've been. Just big enough. So take your perspective on life, on where you've been, and let it be just big enough to help you go where it is that you want to go. And if I can get the person that I sit down with to understand, you and I are going to treat the rearview mirror the way it's intended. We're going to stop making it the windshield, and we're going to look and see what's ahead of you. What do you want to be ahead of you? What has God gifted you with? What are your natural abilities? In fact, when you're angry, what do you normally do? Do you run off at the mouth? Then he's gifted you with the ability to encourage people. But the devil has convinced you through lies that you just tear people down with your words. Though you were given a gift, the devil always counterfeits it. So let's look and see where your counterfeits are at in your life. Once we can identify what those things are, let's turn it 180 degrees and start using it for good. How can you use that pain? How can you channel that? I was sexually abused. One of the ways that I did it, and I didn't even intend for it to be, but I was a criminal investigator at the time, and I taught a women's self-defense class. And I didn't go into details about what had happened to me, but not only was I molested as a child, but I was also raped as an adult male by another male, drugged in my drink, woke up to things happening that I didn't intend to have happen to me, which made me question a whole lot of stuff in my life, right? That aside, when I was listening to these women telling me the similar stories of what had happened to them, empathy is what I had, because I knew how that felt and I knew how horrible it was. But I also knew you can't keep it inside forever. So I always encourage them, if you want to talk to somebody about it, my ears are not attached to my mouth. Safe to tell me what these things are. So I have to establish some level of trust. And if I'm willing to tell you and everybody listening to your show the story about what happened to me, then maybe you can tell me yours. Maybe you can be brave enough to step out on faith, like Peter did, getting out of that boat when he saw Jesus walking on water in the midst of a storm, and stand on the miraculous. I'm asking you to step out of the boat that you're in. Join me out here on the water. It's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to say life sucks sometimes. It's okay to say I'm afraid. What's not okay is to keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. That is insanity. That will keep you stuck. Don't stay stuck. God gave you this life. He made you do on purpose or a purpose. Let's find out what that is. And that's where I start. That's how I do it. And what comes out of their mouth, what they've experienced, where they're at. One of my clients, she told me, I don't believe the way you believe. I'm spiritual. Okay. I didn't push Jesus on her. I also didn't hide from my faith. So she and I started working together 10 plus years ago, before I was doing this as a vocation, but I was doing this on the proverbial side. And that's what made me think, maybe I just need to do this for vocationally. I'm good at it. And when I was working with her, she ended up accepting Christ many years later. But I didn't push that on her, James. I let her see my life. I was a walking, living testimony, screwed up one many days, but she knew I was authentic in my faith. She couldn't reconcile the things that had happened to me any better than I could. And I let her arrive on her journey spiritually to where she needed to go by doing one thing. And that was, just follow me on this path. Let's go through some of these things. Let's dissect them. Let's look at where you've been and where you want to go. And she arrived on her path of purpose on her own. I just got to walk it with her. That's our job, right? That's our job as Christians, especially, is that we have these people who stand on sidewalks and bullhorns yelling at people, you're going to hell. I just want to walk up to them and hug them and say, stop.
Yeah.
There's no point in that, right? Yeah. If you think that's going to change them, it's not. How about you invite them to coffee? How about you listen to their story? How about you try to empathize with where they've been? Yeah, that's what Jesus did. Jesus never told people when he walked on this earth that you got to stop sinning. You got to quit being the little turd bucket that you are. He never said that. In fact, he would meet their needs and then tell them, go sin no more. Now, could they? No. But his intent was, reflect on what I've done for you. I met you with love in the middle of your hurt. Didn't judge you. And all I ask of you is go and don't keep repeating what you're doing. Don't do the insanity trick that we all do. Mm-hmm. Don't keep doing the same thing, expecting a different result. Reflect back on this. And then if you'll see that I'm the reason for it, then you'll probably start changing why you're doing things, because your focus will move from your wind and your waves, and it'll be on Jesus. That's what he asked of Peter when he stepped out of the boat. Just put your eyes on me. Peter did, and he sank, right? Well, we all do. So it's this process of go and sin no more means go and realize you don't have to live your life this way. You don't have to be perfect. You're never going to be. It's why I died on the cross. You already accepted. You ain't got to clean up your life and be this perfect person. You don't have to do it. But the problem is that people think that's who I have to be. And so I can't go to church because those people are a bunch of hypocrites. You're right. We are. We're all a bunch of hypocrites. I'm one of the biggest ones right here. Look at my life. Right? And that's okay. And that's what the church is for. It's for sick people who need a savior, right? Who need help. So why would you come to me? Because you're sick and you're sick and tired of being sick and tired. So if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, give me a call.
Yeah.
If you haven't made it there yet, that's okay. You'll get there. And when you do, give me a call. If it's not me, find somebody you trust. Find somebody who can actually guide you to where you need to go instead of Job's friends who just told him that he must have done something wrong. Otherwise, he wouldn't be in the situation you're in.
Yeah. Wow.
Hate those.
I really enjoyed this conversation, Ricky, and I appreciate your vulnerability and talking about everything you've been through. Really gives me a sense of, man, for you to have gone through those things, come out on the other side and have the heart and the willingness to help other people through that, that's huge. And that's a real service to the world. And I appreciate you for doing that.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. I wanted to kill myself many days in the past. Thankfully, I didn't do it.
Yeah, we're glad you didn't do it, because now you've had many ways open to you, it sounds like, to be able to help a lot of people. And that's important because a lot of people need help.
Yeah. So if anybody listening, you feel like you want to end it right now, learn from me. There may be a good reason why you're here. Don't do it.
Wow. Well, with that, we'll close it out. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, James. Appreciate you having me on my show. And I pray that everybody listening will find their joyful rebellion.
Thank you so much for joining me today. And be sure to come back next week. Oh, and can I ask a favor? I love connecting with people who have either led their own joyful rebellion or professionals who help others through that journey. So if you know someone like that, there's a big yellow button on the homepage at ajoyfulrebellion.com. I'd really appreciate you reaching out with a suggestion or introduction. Thanks again, and I'll see you back here next week.